Hello, Rachel. How are you?
I could be better.
Yeah? Perpetually so? Infinitely so?
Infinitely.
Infinitely better. Well, are you feeling yum yum at least?
No, I'm just feeling yum.
Let me rephrase that. You're feeling yum yum, aren't you?
Oh, yes.
There you go. It isn't the Yum Yum podcast. This isn't our show Yum Yum Trek, in which we talk about Star Trek Discovery. If we aren't both feeling yum yum from the very beginning, hey, we're allowed to maybe feel yum at the end if the episode that we are rewatching of Star Trek Discovery warrants that. But we are always feeling yum yum to be sitting here talking to each other and talking about a show in general. And that is, of course, Star Trek Discovery, which, if you have not seen, spoilers are abound, including for the latest season, Season 3, which some of this episode that we're going to be talking about in Season 2 ties into events of Season 3, so you have been warned.
And the episode we are covering is Perpetual Infinity. Mm. Burnham receives the reunion she's been longing for, but it doesn't go quite as she imagined. Giorgio and Tyler sense a disturbing change in Leland, and it comes in at a 7.2, and it is the 11th episode of the second season.
I was going to ask which episode it is number-wise, because I've kind of forgotten at this point. It feels like this season has been quite an adventure, to say the least, in terms of quality, tone, and overall pacing. Perpetual Infinity. This is the episode that you could basically sum up as the one where Michael's mum tells them that, hey, time is a thing that fucks with you if you fuck with it, and basically I'm stuck in a forever loop of everyone dying all the time, and basically all hope is pointless.
And she basically has the same monologue as
50 times in the same episode?
No, I was gonna say as the guy in Voyager.
Oh, you mean Kurtwood Smith? Yes. In
with the
Year of Hell?
Time has moods. Time
is alive.
Is an entity. Time should be respected.
Or feared.
When I tell you that time has moods, a disposition to be intuited, I'm not speaking metaphorically.
What do you mean?
Anger is one of its moods. Anger and the desire for retribution, vengeance. Time itself has tried to punish me for my arrogance. It has kept me from my wife, denied me my future.
When I first saw this episode, I remembered not liking it at all, mainly due down to one thing, which is Michael's mother. Michael's mother is just that character who has to be on purposely antagonistic, because there needs to be something that happens in the episode. Because if she was just helpful, there would be no episode in the way that
Nothing
Star Trek Discovery would want it to be an
there
episode.
There would be no conflict the way that they construct conflict.
And that's what bothered me that first viewing round, because all I saw was not an actual character. I didn't see the actual conflict. I didn't see the nuances that maybe diehard fans of it see, of this mother-daughter, ooh, I've seen you die 100 times. It's not that I don't understand that. It's, again, I didn't feel that. All I felt was this is a conflict machine being generated inside of the episode. We need the character to railroad the other characters. We need this character to deny the plot and things moving forward, so that way this episode can exist the way that they want it to. I do not like those type of stories. I do not like those type of characters if they're not executed in a certain way. And even in great TV shows, moments like this still bug me.
And they stand out as being lazy.
Not so much just lazy, but just slows down all the pacing, and it feels like dramatic padding.
Well, I bring up laziness because that's basically the way that I feel about this whole episode, is that it's just lazy bullshit.
Well, was that how you felt the first time?
No, I remember being more positive about it last time because there was the hope that it wasn't going to be Michael and she wasn't going to be the center of the universe again.
Yes.
But that's not the case, and it continues to not be the case. So there's no tension anywhere because of that.
But in this episode, the tension still exists in some minor way of, oh no, will Leland, aka Control, get the data and kill her mum?
But this episode, I found it more confusing than I should, because I know what is happening and I know what happens, but large chunks of dialogue made me confused.
Oh, they have just words on the screen and I didn't feel them.
Statements that don't make logical sense, and then statements that are reconstructed to fit the logic of the episode without having any internal logic or making sense for that character to be saying. Like, I just kept on being like, why is that person saying it? Especially when Saru has that monologue
as the hologram.
Like, why is it taking the image of Saru to say all of those things? And then Michael is being not logical at all, but using the facade of growing up Vulcan as her advantage. And then she's saying something, and then I'm not using my position as her daughter, but I'm using my position as her daughter. And they do not recognize the inconsistencies at all. And it just snowballs. And it just got to the point where I was just like, I give up on trying to make sense of this.
I felt those things as well. And those things I will also be able to counter in some ways and see the logic and defend in minor ways, just to play devil's advocate. But overall, this episode I did not enjoy.
It's not because I don't understand why those things are happening. I understand.
You don't like it.
Why? Yes. Because I feel like it's lazy. It's the easy way out. And it is a first draft kind of feeling episode. Even less than that, it feels like they wrote a script from a brain dump brainstorm that they did.
Oh yeah, this definitely feels like the writer's room. They recorded the initial conversation and then just transcribed it into a script. I didn't hate this one as much this time around, surprisingly, because I knew what to expect. I knew that Michael's mother would serve this role. I knew what Michael's mum would serve in the future narrative and what she served to the general season thus far. I knew these things, so I knew what to expect. Thus, I didn't hate the episode outright as much. Again, it's that surrendering yourself to it logic, which is not a compliment on the episode's quality, but more so just the grander picture of it all, just being so overbearing on a rewatch that you just
like control,
you just have to abide by it or you cannot go forward when watching this stuff. What really annoyed me or took me out of this episode, and we've said it many times before, but this episode to me was all of this. Every single line, every single beat was, we've discussed it, trailer talk. And what that actually means is when we say trailer talk,
the visuals in this are very, very trailery.
And what we mean by that, obviously, you can infer, like, oh, obviously we're talking about all of this stuff is you would put in a trailer to entice people into wanting to watch whatever that episode or movie or whatever that is. But in an actual story, in the actual beats, it rings hollow. And that's what we're actually saying when we say trailer talk. Trailer talk is very cliched, it's very tropey. Things have changed and the world is changing and what they built shall fall. All of that, it's very cliched, very trite. But more importantly, in an actual episode like this, when it's all that to someone like me, it's not just it's cliched and trite, it is empty. And the episode is empty to me.
It's completely vacuous. And for me, this episode doesn't have as much of the problem of the end of scene recap.
No.
That was more prevalent in the last episode. But this one has the, I'm going to tell you exactly what's happened because that's me, the character, showing this other person that I'm smart while also telling the audience, because we cannot leave anything to inference. I'm mainly thinking of the scene where Leland gives the thing to Giorgio and there's no tension.
Because she knows.
Because she tells Leland what it is. Yeah. And he goes, well, yeah. But
that's to show that she's clever. But that's to show that she's clever. And they don't know. They do not know how to show. They do not know how to express Giorgio's
anything. They just tell.
They specifically, in this instance, do not know how to show us Giorgio's intelligence without it just being her saying it directly. And that follows into season 3, where, again, spoilers alert, in season 3, they show us her intelligence and the other characters by her disrupting a hologram, which, when we get up to that episode, that's one of the dumbest things I've ever seen. But narratively, script-wise, it's
pretty good.
It's their way of telling us, the audience, Giorgio's really smart. But the way that they do it just either is it's really dumb, like in season 3, or like you're saying here, it removes so much from what could happen in the episode, and all it feels like is the writers telling us.
What you begin to realize is that a picture does literally speak 1,000 words, and that if you can't tell the story visually and people don't get it, then something's missing. You know, if it's just that, there's nothing I love more than focusing on dialogue. So let me just topic sentence that. I love great dialogue.
Hamlet. Hell yeah.
I also have an issue with that scene in particular.
Yes.
Which is, so we have problems with the lack of character consistency. Like, the characters themselves not being consistent and having a built-up personality in terms of, we know that that's them, right?
That, and the other thing that's been mainly happening this season is the wasted understanding, because it's not as if they haven't been consistent with Paul, or they haven't been consistent with Tilly, or they haven't been consistent with Saru or Michael. It's feeling more like they're wasting it and just letting it drip away in some way, or just letting them kind of wither. But yes, what you're saying is also very much a problem we've had as well with characters like Giorgio.
Yeah. So one of the other problems that I had with that scene, because it really stuck out to me as just having lots of layers of problems that we keep on bringing up. Mm. They're just all these bumps, right? Mm. Mm-hmm. And the problem that I have is she is so easily emotionally manipulated.
Oh, Giorgio.
Yeah.
By Leland?
By Leland.
Of course. Because she has to be.
And it doesn't make any sense to me with what we know of her character. Like, yes, she cares about being the most powerful.
Yes.
Person. But I don't feel like she should have been threatened by Michael's mother. I don't think that really makes sense for where we've seen her at now. And it definitely doesn't make sense to me with how Terran they keep on showing her. Mm. Because she should have seen through it. And to me, there's no way that you can cut it with her, like, her being influenced by the Prime Universe and her being Terran, where, like, that mishmash of her character and her emotions, where it makes sense that she takes Leland's lead on this. If it was her idea, I would believe it more, but it's not. It's control as Leland emotionally manipulating her into a situation where she's not doing what she wants, but she is doing what he wants.
I 100% understand what you're saying. I actually disagree with you, but also I do agree. Here's what I mean. I agree in terms of it feels artificial, and it feels forced, and it feels fake. I do not think it's inconsistent for her character to have that as a weakness to exploit and manipulate. We have seen time and time again throughout this season that she does have this issue within her when it comes to Michael. But
yeah,
one of the problems that we... Well, there's many problems here. To go to the actual scene itself, it would be more believable if the writing was more subtle. And I know you could say as a listener listening out there and you're a fan of the writing, well, that's a very cop-out way of saying I don't like the writing. And you could say that all you like. But to me, it is so ham-fisted and forced and very obvious that he's manipulating her. There's no... Like, we know that he's manipulating her, but it's so obvious that he's manipulating her that you would sit there going, how does no one else in the room, including her, not notice that he's obviously manipulating her to do this mission? There's where you need subtlety in the writing, subtlety in the direction. Because if there was more subtlety to that, the reason and the way he's pushing her buttons to make her do the thing makes sense to me.
Or even if she acknowledged it more, that you are pulling on my feelings, you are abusing my relationship with Michael to try and get what you want, but I'm going to do this because it's what I want. If it was more like that, it feels wrong the way that they portray her having agency and also the lack of true agency that she has in that scene because of the way that it's being played overall. And I don't know. It was just like, this is a character that I hate, who is a fascist that I don't care if she's dead or not. In fact, I want that character to be dead. I want that character to suffer repercussions. I do not think that she has been redeemed successfully in this show.
Yeah.
And I do not think that she should be redeemed.
That is what my other issue was. When it comes to this consistency thing, I can see why people who like this character and why the writers think that this is earned, because I can see it. I have a disconnect, just like you, with the Mira Giorgio Empress character from the very beginning. I do not like this character. Since I do not like this character, I cannot connect with this character. No matter how much you try to humanize her and make her empathetic, if I outright reject this character and there's no moment in which I connect with them, I just can't. And the level of evil, we've talked about this before, the level of evil and the point of which we meet her in her level of evil is too much to make it believable to me that she could have a redemption arc. Because again and again and again and again, Deep Space Nine did this, right? Deep Space Nine's villain was Gul Dukat, and Gul Dukat has lots of similarities with Georgiou. But more importantly, one person we haven't mentioned in Star Trek who serves the same role as Georgiou, you could say, is Garak. Garak serves the same role in a lot of ways of he's the duplicitous guy who knows where his true allegiances lies, and he always gives you the morally grey, if not outright dark, point of view of how to solve a situation. And he'll speak sinisterly, but he's also a sassy guy. Garak was not a guy who has committed several genocides of entire species, eats people that he thinks is inferior to him, and not every single line of his...
And still continues to be proud of those actions, even though we're meant to think that she's changed.
And he is not a he came from a fascist background, for sure. But when we meet him, he is a broken man who who's been completely humiliated. He is an outsider from that regime. And you could say that's what Georgiou is, right? She's been removed from her environment. She's now an outsider. She's now completely alone in the universe because she's removed from her own universe.
Yes.
But the thing is, I just do not find her sympathetic because she is a fascist. She has not changed. She has not redeemed. And they think, oh, but she has a motherly bond with Michael that humanizes her. It's that age-old thing of, well, if you have a character that is so villainous, how many humanizing elements can you put on there to make them work? And it depends. It depends, because we've seen so many villains have redemption arcs. I like redemption arcs in villains, but she has always been played as not a villain, though. Okay. That is also something that bugs me, is they've played her from day one as, oh, that wonderful Giorgio. Yeah, she's a bit of a scamp, but she's never really been played as an actual villain that we have to fear. She's always been played as the Garrick character, where Garrick was always kind of around. He said some sinister things. You got implications of what he's done that have been bad, but overall, he works on the side of good, and he's friends with the people we like. And that is cool with Garrick, but with Giorgio, again, it's level of evil. She is more evil than Hitler. She's more evil than Dukat. She's one of the most evil people we've ever encountered in Star Trek's legacy thus far. And there have been characters who have been less evil than her, who we're supposed to have despised. And yet, here we are, trying to care about Leland, manipulating her feelings. I don't care about her feelings. Her feelings are xenophobic and fascist at its core.
You talked them out of it, didn't you?
A planetary slaughter?
Yes. Oh, don't be so dramatic. When I did this in my universe, it didn't wipe out the Klingons. A decent number should be able to save themselves. Plus, they'll have an advantage. No Terran ships firing on them as they try to escape.
There is something that I want to bring up that you brought up, which is that raising a child doesn't make you a good person. But that seems to be the idea behind part of Giorgio's character, is that because she raised Michael, she has the potential for change, she has the potential for growth because she is a mother.
And that's always done in narratives.
I completely disagree with that idea. So they have an even harder time to get me on board with it, because not only am I like, well, she's a fascist, they're saying to me, like, this is one of the, if not the only thing that is her saving grace, is that her parental emotions can be exploited.
Yeah.
And I don't think that that leads to her being able to be a better person.
No. It's in narratives a lot, isn't it? Where it's this idea of the familial bond being a redemption for a character.
And it being the strongest thing in the universe, and you will do everything for family. And sometimes that can be a really interesting thing. Sometimes that can be done really well. But when it is done just as a fallback, which is what it feels like to me, it doesn't feel like that's what they had planned from the beginning, because to me, nothing feels planned from the beginning with Discovery. So it just feels like they're like, oh, well, we need her to do this because we need Ash over here for this later. So we'll have this scene here and, oh, mum versus mum.
Oh, and when did Ash and Giorgio become friends? Did I miss that scene? Sequence of events in which they're like buddy buddies and they're on the
sure
same wavelength?
She actually says friendship.
When did that happen? Did I miss those storylines that happened?
What?
When did that bond happen? Last time I remember them properly.
Fucking no.
I don't know, but apparently it has. Apparently,
maybe that's going to be seen in the Section 31
show. Yeah, they've got to set that dynamic up for the Section 31 show, except for we never
that
saw it.
It still hasn't happened.
But this is all a common thing, right, in media, where, oh, they're the father, they're the daughter, they're the son, brother, whatever, and that means that there's something greater because I can try and change you because I'm good. Like, it's Darth Vader, right? Where you aren't supposed to think at the Return of the Jedi that, oh, well, Vader was space Hitler and he's killed, like, countless people and he's still an evil fascist, but he's redeemed because spirituality and the Force and
his last action
redeems it all. And that's kind of of similar to Georgia in a lot of ways, and that, we've talked about this before. Star Wars, Star Trek, the lines of it are blurring so much that they're indistinguishable from one another
at
this point.
It's like the Terran and the Prime universe just growing closer and closer together when they should be further and further
and
apart.
Deep Space Nine did this too, where Gul Dukat had a daughter in the show, and that was a humanizing factor to him. But I keep mentioning this, Deep Space Nine never forgot that Gul Dukat was the villain. And more importantly, they never forgot what he was. A fascist and a rapist. They never forgot that. They never forgot that about him. They might have indulged in some nuances of his personality that made you conflicted about him, but they never forgot what he was. In this show, they want you to forget that, except for they constantly remind you that Georgiou is a fascist. So her whole entire storyline in this episode is pointless. The episode is just so empty, Rachel. Because what plot happens in this one? Nothing. No plot happens. There's no interesting narrative hook. It is just people conversing in rooms. And I'll describe the episode to you, and every episode of the last part of the season to you, with a direct line from the episode itself that wonderfully encapsulates what is an episode of Star Trek Discovery. There's only the bigger picture now. That's it. It's only the bigger picture now. There is no small details. There is no nuances. There is no quirks,
Ryan,
or interesting moments.
We get to
find
out what Tilly's second favorite law of physics is. That's character development.
This is a classic example of Newton's third law of motion.
Oh, every action has an equal and opposite reaction. Sorry, it's just my second favorite law of physics.
I love great dialogue.
There's that moment in which Michael and Spock, right, have a back and forth about Hamlet, and Michael says, "Hamlet, hell yeah." And that's the level of writing we're at with this episode. This is the episode This is the episode that gave us the infamous line from
Science.
"I Like Science." Can we talk about that scene for 4 hours? Why did he need to say that? Like, obviously, we didn't find it funny. We know that it's there for a comedic stinger because apparently Spock is a comedy machine.
That is what it's there for. But they didn't know how to end that scene because they've finished the exposition dump. They've gotten to the point where they need, but they need to have a stinger at the end. And it's even better if it's trailer bait.
But I just can't wrap my brain around why they thought that one would work.
They thought that it was funny. That is it.
I know humor's subjective. All of this talk is subjective talk.
And all of it's just our opinions.
People get real upset when you talk about this stuff and you say lazy writing and people go, "Well, that's a subjective opinion. How could you say that objectively about writing? Blah, 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 blah. I love it." Which is a subjective way of thinking, by the way. If you really want objectivity, you're thinking subjectively. But
I have a metaphysical question for you. Is there any non-subjective podcast ever?
I don't know.
We haven't got time to answer that.
I just can't believe that scene. Because it's just like them talking, right? It's just a normal technobabble scene. But then it becomes that weird, awkward, hell yeah, Galaxy Pie comedy. And Spock just stops being Spock. Even though I don't buy this guy as Spock. Not the actor, the character itself. He just, it's like his eyes roll back into his head and he's possessed by the writers. And he just says, "I like science." It took me out of whatever that scene was supposed to be anyway, because I'm like thinking about the real world and I'm going, yeah, they know you're a science officer on the most prestigious ship in the entire Federation and Starfleet. I mean,
but he needs to say it so we know. He needs to say it. He can't just show it through that scene where he's shown his investment in science and his capabilities in science. He needs to end the scene with the recap.
I like
science.
It's like if Albert Einstein, just to go to him because the episode did, if he was writing the E equals MC squared on the board for the first ever time and all these other physicists and scientists, like, their jaws dropped on the ground and then Albert Einstein turned around and says, "I like science." What was that? Why did he need to say that? We know that you like science and maths, Albert.
I like science.
There's nothing I love more than focusing on dialogue.
I have nothing to say about this episode. We can go on and on about these little quotes and these little moments, but the actual episode as a whole, there's nothing to discuss here. It is just plain old boring. There's no plot, there's no stakes, there's no tension, there's no real information learned or feelings felt for us. It was, I keep saying this throughout the season, it was as if I watched static for 45 minutes. Yeah. I gained nothing from this experience.
There is something else that I do want to bring up, and I totally agree with you. Like, I have forgotten almost all of this episode, and we watched it less than an hour ago.
Yeah.
And it has just completely slipped from my mind because there's nothing of grit. There's nothing of importance.
There's no character beats that feel true. Nothing feels true. It's empty.
And nothing feels earned. We keep on going back to it being vacuous. And another way that it is that for me is that they... Oh my God. I hate this so much.
What, that mum keeps calling her baby girl?
No.
Because take a drink every time you hear baby and baby girl in this episode. You're fucking dead in the first 5 minutes.
Baby girl.
Come to the table, baby.
I love you, baby girl.
I heard you, baby.
I love you too, baby girl. I'll come back for you, baby girl.
The thing that I want to bring up is, I'm sure I brought this up before, but it was particularly violent in this episode. That's the word that I'm going to go with because it felt assaulting.
Yeah.
Which is them confusing things happening on screen and creating technically some visual interest with making something interesting.
What does that mean?
Okay. So they always overdo the production for me.
Yeah, I saw the wheelchair guy in so many scenes in the background that continuity-wise, it didn't even make sense anymore. Yep. Like, I was thinking about it, I'm like, continuity-wise, this is fucking weird.
Okay, so there's two little moments that I want to bring up.
Mm-hmm.
So the first one is when Michael is watching the video and then she puts her hand through the screen.
Yeah, because you have to show that it's a hollow screen.
You have to show that it's a hollow screen. It's not enough for her to do that.
Even though the screen's translucent.
We have to see the effect and the camera spins. And then there's multiple sound effects when she's doing that as well as the music, I swear. And it's all of these layers of production that are meant to be bolstering this moment to make it feel emotional.
Yeah.
And it just makes it ring even more hollow for me. So that's one.
Yeah, with the music. Let's never forget that. I mean, we always talk about it, but the music does that too. But yeah, you're saying it. Like, a lot of the production is trying to bolster up this script. At the end of the day, all what you're saying is you're noticing the production. And that's saying a lot about how weak the script is. Because if you're being distracted by how overbearing the production elements are down to effects, that means the story being told isn't very strong.
And then the other moment that I groaned and left the room because I was so disappointed in this decision, which was the high-speed, slow-mo fight between Giorgio and Leyland at the end of the episode.
Oh, did Guy Ritchie come around? Did he decide that he was going to edit a scene? Did he? Did Zack Snyder take over for a moment there and thought, ooh, 300? Yeah.
It doesn't match as well. It feels like they just went, that looks cool, let's do that. Not, this helps tell the story, this makes it more interesting. It's, this makes it look cool. And that's really what I'm talking about, is that they seem so much more concerned with making things look cool than having them make sense and have a purpose. And I get that you can have a purpose, but for me, it's not them building blocks. It them making a straw man more than them building on what they have. And it's just so frustrating because with each new episode, they're just adding more straw and giving themselves a pat on the back, going, look at all of this great stuff that we've done. Look at all of these great characters we have. Look at how progressive we are. And I'm like, this means nothing to me. And it doesn't feel like it should mean anything to me.
You're right. There is a disconnect inherently between the internal logic of the world and the external logic of our world. They want to have all of these things here, but the internal logic of the world doesn't abide by that.
It's complicated when they bring in stuff from previous Star Trek shows. When you actually think about this being what now, maybe 9-8 years before Kirk and Spock on the Enterprise. You think about that, it's even worse.
There is a major disconnect, though. You're saying it. There's a major disconnect as a viewer from the internal logic and the external factor of the writers. There's a moment at the very beginning, and you're not supposed to think about this. As an audience member, you're not supposed to think about this. And that's fine. To me, this is where I'm at, though, from the very beginning. I've been noticing these things, and it takes me out as a viewer. And I say to myself, there is such thing as intelligent writing, but there's a lot of we want spectacle over coherent. So there's a moment at the beginning.
Struggled with the lack of substance.
There's a moment at the beginning where we see Michael's parents get killed, or when the Klingons come, and the first thing I said was, oh, Klingons don't use cloak anymore, because they got seen through a telescope, they're not wearing a cloak. And I go, okay, that's okay. Maybe they don't want a cloak, or maybe they didn't have it yet. You could tell me, nerds of Star Trek, maybe they didn't have it when Michael's parents got attacked. But then I start thinking about it more. They land on the ground and the whole building shakes, and I'm trying to think from a coherent point of view, not a spectacle point of view. The spectacle is big old Klingons with their big old spaceship lands, and they come in guns blazing, shooty, 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 and Michael's mum teleports out just as a laser's about to hit her in the fucking face. I'm thinking coherently. I'm thinking, wait a moment, wasn't the original goal of the Klingons to acquire the technology that they have built because this is time travel technology? So why would the Klingons, who have been shown to be intelligent in this own series, why would they decide that they would fly their spaceship down, land it in front, run in with phasers and just start shooting everyone when they have transporters? Why won't they just transport the people in there onto their ship, take them prisoner, and take the technology and interrogate them? Get more information about the technology, how it works. Or more importantly, why don't they just teleport their men down to the surface or even into the room and do the shooty shooty? They lose the element of surprise. They lose the element of coherent logic of, well, weren't the Klingons wanting this? Well, if they want this, wouldn't it make logical sense that they would do this, 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 and this to acquire that? But it's about the spectacle. Slow-mo fight scene between Leland is more important than the Michael's mother being a transporting away making sense.
Yeah.
We don't have time to set up that the Klingons were intelligent. We want them to run in guns blazing and just shoot people and fuck up because we want to have the spectacle of that. And we come to Star Trek not for the spectacle, but for the thought process, for the substance. And I want to just say, Rachel, there is substance within this episode, mm-hmm. but it's buried underneath all of this spectacle. Because when we say there's no substance, that's not right to say. Because there are people who like this show, but and it's not like we don't see any substance. It's we can see it, but it's buried underneath so much stuff that it's so minute that it barely even counts. And more importantly, it doesn't affect us as a viewer. The substance that's there between her and her mum, I don't feel it because of all of this schlock put on top of it. All these terrible lines, all these terrible choices made by the direction, by the writing. Again, disconnected from the coherency of the world.
The thing that I love about television is that you can spend real time getting into the nuances and the smaller details of characters' lives and arcs that you just don't have time for in 2 hours. And I think that's a wonderful opportunity. It's a wonderful gift. So when you watch the show, you'll go, wow, those are some massive sequences. But the key, and it's what all the writers and we're all constantly striving for, is to make sure that we're not losing the small intimacy and that the big isn't overshadowing the little.
Michael's mother,
yeah,
proposes in this episode that all the outcomes fail and that there's no way of defeating control that she's figured out yet. So she must keep trying. But because time is a bitch, time is punishing Michael's mother for having time traveled in the first place and trying to interfere with the natural order of time, thus letting control win all the time. Correct? That's her assumption. That's her logic.
That is the way that I understood this episode.
And her thought process to win is gotta put the data on Discovery so that Discovery can protect the data from control and thus they'll win somehow. Why does she think that? They say a bunch of things in the episode, but what's the... why would that work?
I don't know.
There's a moment here that answers one of our previous questions from another episode, the O Before Charon, which is the one where the sphere comes. And I asked, well, why would the red signal lead them to find the sphere in the first place if the sphere data is what's causing all the problem? Why not just let the sphere die and nobody gets the data? Or why not just destroy the sphere and destroy all the data? Control wouldn't evolve then. There's a line of dialogue in this episode that actually answers that question, Rachel.
Wow.
And I was so glad that she said the answer because I completely forgot it. And that again,
this is Dr. Burnham explaining it?
Yeah, yeah. She says, I've destroyed the sphere in the past and it still doesn't work. That's the answer. Why?
I thought that line was saying that she tried to destroy the sphere and that she couldn't manage to destroy it.
No, I was under the assumption that she's destroyed the sphere in the past, but it still doesn't work.
Okay.
Because then you could say...
either way it works as a patch.
That doesn't answer... either one doesn't answer why that... why control still wins. Because she's directed Discovery there on purpose. So that means in the original timeline, nobody stumbled upon the sphere data because the sphere was dying in the middle of nowhere. So she's the reason that they discovered it. But then you're not supposed to think about it. You're just supposed to take, oh, it just doesn't work. So why does putting it on the Discovery work? Because we want to project the Discovery ship into the future, which they set up in this episode. The perpetual infinity idea. They're just setting up, well, we're just going to time jump 950 years into the future at the end of the season because we've trapped ourselves within the timeline of Star Trek.
Yeah.
And we want to be free of that.
And also...
a problem that they put on themselves. Nobody asked for them to set it in this time. They decided to, and they trapped themselves within it. So how do we solve the problem? Completely reset the show.
We have the ties, we have the connective tissue to the canon that we have always had, but now we're somewhere where we've never been before. So it's boldly going where no one has ever gone before. And being able to create canon, every choice you make, every step of the way, there is something so empowering and emboldening and humbling about that.
There's a great moment here in which Michael's mother's doing the whole, I did this all for you, and I want to be here with you, and I love you.
I saw you in all of these poignant moments that we've also done flashbacks of so we can reuse the footage.
And I love you, and I'm doing this all for you, and when time is reset, I am coming back to you.
Your dad.
And your dad. But we have now, and then at the end, obviously that's not going to happen because she's now flung in 950 years into the future. So she's stuck in the future.
Yeah.
However, now on a rewatch and having rewatched season 3, I despise her character even more because we meet her in season 3 and she just kind of stumbles across Michael. She's now joined the Romulan warrior nuns because terrible. And she completely is a fucking bitch to Michael because she's now loyal to these Romulan warrior nuns, and it makes it out in season 3 that her goal is to preserve life and the truth, while in this it was not just about preserving life. She literally says, I'm doing this for you. So when we meet her in season 3 and she's completely cold and barren to Michael and doesn't want to really interact with her and just wants to flail about with the Romulan warrior nuns, it makes her motivation in this episode seem completely pointless and hollow, because her real motivation and her real drive isn't actually Michael, it turns out in season 3. She still loves Michael, she still has feelings for Michael, sure, but not enough to actually want to try and reach out and find out what's all. No, she wants to preserve life and the truth, and hence she joins Romulan warrior nuns. And so when I watch this episode back, I look at her character and I think, what a waste of time.
Speaking of a waste of time, is it time for the Hudal?
He was here. He said medical exposition, which was nice. It showed that he's a doctor again. And they reaffirmed that he's been reinstated for 5 minutes, which is great.
And then he kind of said, I take backsies to the exposition that he gave last episode, where he was like, it definitely is you because there are neural wild cards. And now he's saying, well, you know, there's a lot of similarities between DNA, between
of mothers and daughters in particular.
But I was 100% sure that it was you, and now I guess it's your mum, and I'm 100% sure of that.
At the end of last episode, they left it on the cliffhanger that Hugh was wanting to talk to Paul and patch up their relationship, but it wasn't the right time. This episode, Paul and Hugh don't even mention one another, let alone interact.
They are both down on the planet, though, at the same stage.
But they don't interact.
But they don't interact.
And you know what that is? Drawing out the drama, because it could be just resolved here, right now, in this episode. But we've got to draw it out to the
episode for it.
We've got to draw it out to the very end of the season, where
but
Paul gets into a life-threatening situation.
Drama in this episode, because
do we?
Of Michael.
Do
and
we? Are you fucking kidding me?
No, that's what they think. That's what they think. That's not what I think. That is what I'm projecting onto the writers. They're like, this is the interpersonal drama that we are dealing with. We will deal with the Paul and Stamets. We will deal with the Hugh and Paul stuff later. They're still dealing with this crisis, and Paul is helping with this. So when that's done, maybe we'll get to it.
It's a coherency issue to me. I'm just disconnected, because to me, they're at that point in which all they need is a single conversation and it would be resolved. But they're not going to do that because they want the spectacle of the drama of them having their feuding, tearing apart, falling apart relationship. And all it says to me is they don't know what to do with those two characters. They don't know what to do with them.
They want
as a couple, but as individual characters, they just don't know what to do with them at this point.
Let them be happy, because happy couples are boring.
Yeah. From a writer's standpoint, it's hard to draw drama from them, you could say, but there's been many shows that have succeeded. But I just think as a character, Hugh Colbert is completely pointless. They don't know what to do with him. They've never known what to do with him. And just 2 seasons in, in fact, 3 seasons in, and we still don't know jack shit about him. Season 3 admittedly has given him a character of some sort, or at least characterization.
And they were
but
setting that up a little bit in this episode, where he's becoming kind of the patron saint for people who are having issues with their identity.
And that's Hume. He served purpose, but overall completely pointless. And waste screen time, but that's where we're at. This episode sucked. I give it a yum.
Yeah. Oh, it's a yum from me.
Yeah.
I feel like we've said a lot and said nothing at the same time. It's one of those where there's things that we didn't even touch upon that happened in this episode, sure. But overall, this is just another entry in season 2 that feels like static. I just watched white noise happen in front of me for 45 minutes. I will not remember this episode very much outside of Michael's mum was in it, and that's all I will remember. When we get to our season 2 recap, this will be another one of those episodes where I go the title and say, I think I gave it a yum or yum yum, I don't know, because it's just so bland and forgettable, and it is that line of it's all the big picture now, that's it. Rachel, what chapter of the larger narrative are we going to be subjected to next time?
Through the Valley of Shadows.
Ooh. Through the Valley of Shadows. Dramatic title.
A fourth signal leads the USS Discovery to an insular world where Pike is forced to make a life-changing choice. Burnham and Spock investigate a Section 31 ship gone rogue, leading to a discovery with catastrophic consequences.
Yeah, Bitsy, you remember the Menagerie episode of Discovery? We already did the Remember the Cage, now we're up to the Remember the Menagerie. I do, guys. We'll be up to that one next time on the Yum Yum Trek discussion. Rachel, where can the people out there find us on the internet?
Well, they can easily check out the description for our links of various socials, usually at Yum Yum Pod, and shoot us an email at yumyumpod@gmail.com if they are so inclined, and check out our Patreon if they want even more content and contact with us.
Yes, check out our Patreon. Yes, we do have a Patreon in which we talk about the other Star Trek shows, some of the movies, and just other shows in general. Things are abound on there, and you can support us. It would be greatly appreciated. Feel free to rate and review us on whatever podcatcher allows us and you to do so. Rachel, I...
Excuse me, but what happened before no longer exists.
Oh, so all of this was pointless, huh?
What will happen next has not yet been written.
Oh.
We only have now.